Hola, Sue. So the last event in the last cycle, as we come to our final guided meditation for this retreat, I thought it would be good to end with a grand finale, a great encompassment, at least my best job, best I can do to give a great encompassment of what we're doing in these complementary practices of the three modes of shamatha and the four measurables. So let's review. Let's stand back now. Big wide-angle lens, fisheye lens, big panoramic view. Mindfulness of breathing. We're focusing on something that is corporeal, tactile sensations of the breath. But in so doing, we're releasing, to a considerable extent, we're releasing our minds, our thoughts, our memories, images, emotions we don't really care about, whatever. I'm sorry, I'm busy, I'm focusing on something so interesting, tactile sensations of the breath. So releasing the mind, releasing the psyche, simplifying, doing something just so simple as just focusing on an ongoing flow of non-conceptual awareness of tactile sensations. Of course, there's more to the mindfulness of breathing than that, but let's move right on to settling the mind in its natural state as we now attend to the mind. To the mind, meaning this whole array, the stage and all the mental events that arise upon it, we're attending closely, very mindfully, but to the best of our ability without identifying with anything at all, not taking ownership, not taking responsibility. Some thought comes up of some horrendous evil act. I'm not taking responsibility for it. It just occurred in my space. I'll sit you out. You know, but I'm not taking responsibility for that. No way. This maybe came from television, or a movie I saw 10 years ago, or, you know, a newspaper report. I'm not taking responsibility. That's not mine. Somebody else put it there. So what we're doing here is we're allowing the mind to be a mind, but we're not owning it, not identifying with it, not taking possession, not trying to control it, which is really integral to possession. I possess because I control, and we're releasing control, which means release ownership. I mean, really, that's kind of what it means, right? If I give my iPhone away, said, here, Glenn, have an iPhone. He said, thanks, I've always wanted an old iPhone. 3 series, huh? Good, I'll pass it on to my grandchildren as a as a dinosaur. You know, but as soon as I give it to him, he said, oh, thanks, Alan, this is a really good paperweight. That means I've lost control. That's it. I mean, the bottom line is now I've lost control. If he wants to use it as a paperweight or a doorstop, he wants to use it just to, you know, exercise a new hammer, whatever he wants to do with it, I got no control. I gave it to him. What can I do? No control. I don't own it anymore. So we're giving up control. We're giving up ownership over our own minds. And in so doing, finding out that the mind can't maintain itself all by itself. It needs to be fueled by identification. And we have lots of experience of doing that. But when we close the valve of the fuel of grasping, then the mind dies a natural death. It doesn't die by being hit with a heavy blow by some anesthetic or brain damage or something like that. It dies a natural death of unraveling itself, dissolving itself, dissolving like mist fading in the sunlight. And then it's gone. And the mist of your psyche has vanished, and it leaves only the clear sky of substrate, illuminated by substrate consciousness. Now, there's one approach. Another approach, of course, is right from the very beginning, or later on as you wish, to, as if you're getting out your laser and just piercing right through that fog bank of your psyche, and saying, just don't care. A laser will go right through fog. Powerful laser, cut right through it. And so you're just shooting right through your psyche, right through to the ground from which your psyche emerges. Awareness of awareness. In either case, the sense of identification through any of these three trajectories of shamatha, these three modes, the trajectory is to move beyond identification, number one, with your own body, Because in any form of shamatha, even mindfulness of breathing, eventually, of course, you disengage from tactile sensations. You go to the acquired sign or to the counterpart sign, which means you are disengaging from your body. You're ignoring it. And from your perspective, after some time, you just have no corporeal presence. Now, obviously, your body is still there, but not from your perspective, any more than you have a body when you're deep asleep from your perspective. So we're disengaging our identification with our own bodies in all shamatha practices. And in all shamatha practices, by hook or crook, by one method or another, we are disengaging our identification with coarse mind, which is where our personality is lodged, where our sense of personal history is lodged, where our hopes and fears for the future are lodged. They all have their home in our psyche, and we're releasing identification with the body, the coarse body, and the coarse mind, cutting through both to a field of energy that pervades the substrate, which is called the subtle body, and to the subtle mind, which is called the substrate consciousness. So you've just relinquished a very localized, temporally and spatially localized, sense of who you are and what you own. You've relinquished it. So there you are, resting in the substrate consciousness, non-conceptually, but not absolutely non-conceptually. It's a murmur. It's subliminal. It's precognitive. But there is a flow of conceptualization there. It's not chatting. It's precognitive. It's beyond the control of, it's beyond voluntary control. Because, and the indication of that is there can still be grasping, and there will be grasping, clinging, craving, desire for the bliss, the luminosity, the non-conceptuality. And those are conceptual processes. Every mental affliction, 84,000 of them, all are hosted by a conceptual mind. There are no non-conceptual mental afflictions. There are non-discursive ones, but they're all hosted. Just like bubonic plague was hosted by fleas, mental afflictions are hosted by conceptual mind. So you slip into the substrate consciousness. And there's still quietly murmuring there, like a hibernating bear, growling quietly. Sense of I am, still there. I am, I want, I like. Luminosity, I like. Bliss, I like. Non-conceptuality, like. Still there. Hibernating bear, but he's not dead, just hibernating. So there's something localized there. Not explicitly in space, except for the space of your own awareness, which doesn't have any center or periphery. Not explicitly in time, because there's no very clear sense of passage of time when you're simply resting non-conceptually in the substrate consciousness. Nevertheless, there is a certain locality to it. The reality of it is that your substrate consciousness is localized in a particular point of time, and it is localized in a particular place, even if it's not evident to you from a first-person perspective. But then what do you do? I mean, the real fast track, Dujum Lingpa, Dujum Rinpoche, refers to this, is just going right to the substrate, and then just, if you're one of those extremely ripe individuals, go to the substrate, and just like a, ever seen an express train that just zips right through the little towns and doesn't even slow down? Yeah, you've seen them go by, you've been on them. The express train dissolving your substrate, dissolving your coarse mind, passing right through the little town of your substrate consciousness and not slowing down, not grasping. Oh, that's a pretty town. That's my town. Oh, it's a town of bliss, luminosity, non-conceptual. I want to stop there. Just express train. Just keep on moving. Releasing all preference. If you can imagine, it's hard to imagine, experiencing bliss and not preferring it, experiencing luminosity, not preferring it, not the serenity, the ocean-like serenity of non-conceptuality, and not preferring it. And that's exactly what the doctor ordered to achieve the breakthrough beyond the substrate consciousness, like a hot knife through butter, like an express train right through a little town, breaking right through the substrate consciousness. And then, oh, wide open, atemporal, non-local, non-individuated. That is, you're not tapping into, even though it's often said, and it's in the classic text by the great, great accomplished masters, you're seeing your own face. You're seeing the nature of your own awareness. Rang, rang, rang. Comes up a lot. Your own, your own, your own. But it's not individuated. Because your own pristine awareness is not different than, not other than, not a different substance than the pristine awareness of someone else. When it comes to coming to Gelugpa terminology, when it comes to Dharmakaya, and of course from the Dzogchen perspective, Dharmakaya is nothing other than Rigpa. Rigpa is nothing other than Dharmakaya. But to come to Gelugpa terminology, although there are many Nimanakaya, countless Nimanakaya, and actually countless Sambhogakaya, for every Buddha there's a Sambhogakaya. But when it comes to Dharmakaya, the mind of the Buddha, Chukku Nyakchik, there is but one. There's but one Dharmakaya. So you've tapped into a dimension of consciousness, though, that now coming back to the Dzogchen perspective, is actually beyond the very demarcation of one and many. Beyond the demarcation of existence and non-existence, beyond space, beyond time, beyond all prapancha, beyond all conceptual elaborations, all conceptual constructs, does not compute, cannot be captured, cannot be articulated, neither literally nor by way of metaphor, can't be captured. You've relinquished your identification even with your own substrate consciousness, which is the repository of your memories, past life experiences, the repository of your whole spiritual evolution. You've relinquished identification with that. And having relinquished identification with a coarse mind, with a subtle mind, relinquished identification with your own personal history, and all that is unique about yourself as a separate individual, having relinquished all grasping to all of that, now for the first time you come to know who you are. And so from Dzogchen perspective, from the words of my precious teacher, Gyatso Rinpoche, said there's one difference between Buddhas and sentient beings. Buddhas know who they are. Sentient beings don't. Now, from each of these perspectives, and let's even take a step back to... I'm sorry, but for me, it just looks like a brain damage perspective. It's hard to imagine how anybody can think this and not be brain damaged, but it is true, which shows the limitations of my imagination. But to take a step back from all of that, back from coarse mind, and imagine that someone has waved a wand over your head to completely, not completely, but to deeply stupefy you. Stupefy you to believe as if just somebody, like they've hypnotized you. Like you're a frog. You're a frog. Or years ago I saw a television, I think, some master hypnotist, and he hypnotized a young black guy, maybe 20, 25 years old, a very handsome young black guy. Hypnotized him. Up on stage, it was a performance. Hypnotized him to think make him think he was a kangaroo. It was a performance. This kind of thing happens all the time. But I watched it, and it was incredibly cute. Kind of silly, but incredibly cute, because this black guy, that he puts his hands up like this, and then he jumps around the auditorium, a happy kangaroo, you know. You're kind of expecting to see a big tail come out of the back of him because he really kind of looked like a kangaroo. Black kangaroo. Happy kangaroo. And then, you know, and you just say, where's your little babies, you know? And for that while, he really thought he was a kangaroo. It was very cool. Well, some people get hypnotized to think they're kangaroos, and some people get hypnotized to think that they are only bodies. That only the physical is real, and all subjective experience is illusory, and mental events don't really exist at all. It's only brain function. And you can't really observe your own thoughts. Introspection doesn't really exist. And some people hop around like that for a long time. The people who originated this hypnotic spell really stagger my imagination. How much thought went into drawing the conclusion that thought doesn't exist? That's really hard to imagine. I can't. But this was taught at Harvard. It wasn't taught at Podunk Village for the mentally retarded in some village in central Kansas. It was taught at Harvard, and it was mainstream. It was considered cutting-edge radical behaviorism. And the same thing at Oxford, same thing at Stanford, and so forth. Our premier universities in the world were teaching this for decades. Wow, that really staggers the imagination. To be so radically, to be mesmerized, hypnotized, stupefied so drastically that you are alienated from your own experience, your own immediate experience of your own mind, staggers the imagination. Nowadays, that kind of radical behaviorism is kind of like, ha 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 ha, you know, like, hee hee, just kidding, or they made a little mistake, ha ha ha. But now we know it's really the brain. You know, so now they take something they don't understand, subjective experience, and they see it's correlated with something they do understand, at least better and better, the brain, and then they take what they don't understand and say, oh, what the heck, it's probably what we do understand, and let's just say they're the same. I mean, there used to be something called logic, but logic seems to have just gone up in smoke here, because there is no logic to this at all. To take a marvelous mystery of the nature of subjective experience and then say, well, shucks, we don't understand it. We don't understand how it relates to the brain, how it influences the brain, how the brain influences it. Well, why don't we just call it the brain, and things do get simpler. So let's just call it the brain. And that's what's happened. And it swamps the media nowadays. And the media, who are supposed to be so critical, who are responsible for Watergate and so many other things, unveiling political corruption and so forth, they're just swallowing this down like puppies lapping up milk. I'm astonished. So you've heard me say this before, and maybe this is the last time in this eight weeks. Just wait until next spring. From their perspective of materialism, from the perspective of I am just a brain and there's nothing to me but brain function, subjective experience is unimaginable. It's incomprehensible, cannot be understood, doesn't make any sense. So, for the radical materialist, it doesn't exist. Like my professor at Stanford, when I asked him what's the nature of a visualized mental object, he said it doesn't exist. And I said, why? Because it's not physical. And again, like, it's almost like getting an electric shock, like electric shock treatment for your philosophy students. Like, you know, will so stun your frontal cortex that it will just numb you to common sense. So, Russian dolls here. If you're locked into the peanut size worldview of materialism, your own experience of your own mind becomes incomprehensible, doesn't make any sense, and is reduced to nothing. Or at best, an illusion. This is in mainstream scientific journals, mainstream media, and scientific textbooks. So one would think this would be in a really stupid, crazy little offshoot of some nutty professor. But in fact, it's unfortunately the nutty professors dominate. So in terms of Russian dolls, there's the smallest peanut. That I am just a brain, I'm just physical, subjective experience, unless it can be clearly identified, equated with physical, doesn't exist at all, or it's illusory. So from the materialistic perspective, your psyche, your immediate experience of your own mind, doesn't exist, except as an illusion, or doesn't exist at all. And the person who really promoted this view within philosophy, an eliminative materialist, got a genius award. Literally got a genius award. It's called the MacArthur Award for really promoting this with greater clarity and force and so forth than anybody else. Wow. I keep on getting electric shocks from modernity. Like, is this? Do I really have to be in this century? Because this is just too crazy for me to handle. So from a materialist perspective, your psyche doesn't exist. Decisions don't exist. All the cognitive functions are produced by neurons. They're doing everything, and you, the mind, doing nothing. You're just a puff of smoke. You're a brain fart. Just some kind of function, an epiphenomenon emerging out of neuronal activities. But now if we move beyond that to mainstream psychology, I think most, certainly clinical psychologists have to be more realistic than this. For a person to come in and say, I'm feeling profound depression, and you say, no, you're not. That's just a chemical imbalance in your brain. But don't tell me about your mind because you don't have one. But let me study your brain. I mean, they wouldn't come back. They'd say, you're crazier than I am. So clinical psychologists, psychotherapists, they can't be this crazy because people are coming to them with real problems. And even if it's treated with just drugs, 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 well, at least I don't think psychotherapists or psychiatrists say, oh, no, they won't. They say, that mental problem doesn't exist. It's only in your mind. That kind of doesn't wash, So there is a domain of modern science, clinical psychology, psychiatry. Certain aspects of cognitive psychology are not completely reductionistic, where they're actually taking seriously subjective experience. It does happen. But if that's the peanut you're in, the Russian doll, but let's say a larger peanut, then substrate consciousness doesn't exist. And what do they say? When you go into deep sleep, you're not conscious. When you're anesthetized, no consciousness. When you become vegetative, no consciousness. Comatose, no consciousness. Hit the final stage of death, no consciousness. They can't see it, doesn't exist. So now we see the same thing done all over again. It doesn't fit within the psyche. We can't measure it. We can't perceive it. We can't detect it. Therefore, it doesn't exist. Right? Now, let's imagine that you're a Buddhist practitioner and you've practiced shamatha. And you rest in the substrate consciousness and you see this is as real as footballs, galaxies, as real as anything else in the universe. This substrate consciousness is, it's happening, it's a happening. You know, it's got qualities, it does things, it's wow, it's really a happening. This is as real as anything else, certainly as real as any of that stuff happening in the psyche, let alone that stuff happening in the brain. This is as real as anything. So let's imagine now this is your mode. And you come out, you engage with the world. Let's even imagine you purify your mind. Let's imagine you even realize nirvana and become a stream enterer. And a once returner, a non-returner. But you're locked within the causally conditioned mind, the five skandhas, the physical and then the four mental. You're locked within the continuum of consciousness that is causally conditioned, conditioned by karma, by klesha, and of course conditioned by the body, genetics, and so forth and so on. If that's the peanut you're in, and then you ask, what happens when I, the arhat, die? And that continuum of conditioned consciousness ceases. Does not compute, does not compute, does not compute. So the Buddha often responded with silence, knowing that if he said, oh, you do exist, you fall into the extreme of substantialism. You think, oh, good. I survive. I'll be in Nirvana heaven. I hope there's a lot of people we can hang out with. You know, so you'll grasp onto I am after death as an arhat. And if the Buddha said, well, actually, sorry, but you know, conditioned consciousness completely terminates. All of your skandhas terminate. That's it. Oh, bummer. Total annihilation. The materialists got it so easily. They just had to die. But now, after all my work, I just get total annihilation. Bummer. Well, whatever you say, it's wrong. Whatever you say, people have the wrong idea. So on many occasions, the Buddha responded with noble silence. It's unimaginable. From the perspective of conditioned consciousness, the unconditioned consciousness, Rigpa, unimaginable. It can't even be imagined as existence or non-existence. Therefore, some Buddhists looking at this, some Western scholars of Buddhism also, look at this and they say, okay, the arhat achieves, the practitioner achieves stream entry, gains realization of emptiness. Very cool, got it. Some mental fiction is purified. And then once returner, then non-returner, then arhat. Very cool, very happy, very peaceful mind. And then total continuum of all five skandhas cut. Oh, that means nirvana means obliteration. And there are actually some Buddhists who still say that. That the culmination of this is to absolutely stop samsara, which means absolutely stop the continuum of consciousness, which means become absolutely unconscious, which means become non-existent. So they fall into one more case of nihilism. We see this, the sequence here. That which is in the bigger shell you can't see, and not seeing it, you think it's non-existent. From the perspective of a person, let's say a Dzogchen practitioner, the great encompassment, the largest peanut, from that perspective, the unconditioned nirvana makes perfectly good sense. You've realized it. The substrate consciousness, the bhavanga, makes perfectly good sense. You've realized it. The psyche makes perfectly good sense. We've all realized that. And the brain, with brain chemistry and now with the benefits of modern science, genetics, and all the subtleties of this physiological organism, all makes perfectly good sense. Perfectly good sense from the Dzogchen perspective. Everything makes perfectly good sense from the largest perspective. But the smallest perspective, nothing outside of it makes sense. Larger perspective, nothing outside makes sense. Nothing out. And whenever it doesn't make sense, the conclusion is doesn't exist. Subjective experience doesn't exist. Substrate consciousness doesn't exist. Rigpa doesn't exist. Then arhat at death gets terminated. It becomes nothing. So there's a real clear asymmetry there. It's crucial. That's why in Dzogchen it's called the great encompassment. Everything makes sense. Vajrayana makes sense. Even from a strict Vajrayana developmental perspective, there is only one real fast track to enlightenment if you don't want to spend three countless eons, stage of generation. And this is a lot of work. Oh, it's a lot of work. It's realizing emptiness, it's developing bodhicitta, developing extraordinary visualization abilities, it's sustaining the awareness of emptiness as you're generating yourself as a deity and the environment and all the beings within it, sustaining all of that, purifying, setting up, purifying, modulating your whole subtle energy system, and then going to stage of completion, radically alterating, getting all the energies into the central channel. And so there is a view. There is a stage of generation completion. If that's your whole notion of Vajrayana, Dzogchen makes no sense. It makes no sense. You just sit there? You just sit there doing nothing? And you're going to realize Dharmakaya? A lot of galupa geshe would say, give me a break. Fuzzy thinking. But never mind the fact that Tsongkhapa, having received Dzogchen teachings, and I can show you exactly where he said this, Tsongkhapa, having received Dzogchen teachings from a master, reviewed the Dzogchen teachings and said, this system is complete and perfect. So it's really quite funny when followers of Tsongkhapa then refute him. How clever they are. To be more clever than Tsongkhapa. That's very, very clever. The larger view always makes sense of the smaller view. The smaller view can never make sense of the larger view. With humility, then one may say, I just don't understand. Without humility, one says, it doesn't exist. We're bringing together two themes here. The shamatha on the one hand, relinquishing, the grasping onto I am of I, me, and mine. Relinquishing grasping of all kinds. Reification of self, of others, subject and object. To the point of realizing rigpa, in which all grasping is utterly finished. All localization finished. All closely held, all close holding of the skandhas as my skandhas, my body, my mind, completely and irreversibly released into an expanse that transcends space and time. What are we doing with the four immeasurables? And what tendencies do we already have that make us vulnerable to emotional imbalances, upsets, turbulence, so forth? I would suggest, I think this is kind of obvious, but it's also pretty profound, that what makes us so vulnerable to all the emotional upsets from what happens from day to day, meditation session to session, person to person, economic situation to situation, election to election? It's grasping. It's localized grasping onto mine, a very local me and mine, my body. Oh, today was a bad day. Why was it a bad day? stomach upset. 100 people just died in Iraq because somebody blew up a bomb. They thought that would be a really good idea to help the country. But this is a bad day because I have a stomach upset. This was a bad day because the sessions during the afternoon weren't as good as the ones in the morning. It was a kind of bad day. It rained when I wanted to go out walking. I had to carry an umbrella. I don't like carrying an umbrella. I kept my hands free. That was kind of a bad day, holding umbrella. I should at least have somebody hold an umbrella for me. Then I can be the holy Joe with mantra and somebody running behind. That'd be a good day. So we become vulnerable because our sense of identity is so tiny in space and in time. It was a bad day because I had bad sessions in the morning. Bad day in the afternoon, I felt really depressed. Collapsed down into a little tiny sliver of time, and we feel bad. A little tiny little microcosm of space, like the space of the body, the space of our own minds. And topsy-turvy, topsy-turvy, and the world, this massive infinite world around us, impinging upon this little tiny microcosm of our body-mind. And we're going from up and down, bad day, good day, topsy-turvy emotions flying all over the place. And then Lerap Dingba says, cut through it. Release your identification with the body, which is simply released during settling the mind in its natural state. Release all grasping to your own mind and find, as a result of this, that you remain in a constant state of composure. You're grasping onto nothing. You're not grasping to your body. You're not grasping to your own mind. It still happens. Mind is still happening. Body is still happening. But the identification isn't there. The emotional turbulence, the ups and downs, the instability becomes more and more a thing of the past. So there are two trajectories for achieving this equanimity, sublime equanimity, even transcendent equanimity of a Buddha, let alone the equanimity of the four immeasurables, equanimity of shamatha. And that is to withdraw all identification. Away from the body, away from the mind, away from the substrate, right into pristine awareness. But the more there is identification with my body, my mind, but of course none of us stop there. So one person, one of you mentioned not long ago, in terms of developing loving kindness, develop equanimity. This person mentioned, and I think he speaks probably for all of us, or at least many of us here, if I bring to mind somebody who treated me bad, I can develop some equanimity, maybe even some loving kindness. But if I bring to mind someone who has or will or might mistreat my family, my own children, my spouse, oh, that's difficult. That's difficult. Well, I think we can all resonate with that. I'm citing this not because that was some weirdo or that was some oddball. I think we can relate to that. How big is the field now of I and mine? Because in this case, especially with parents, there's not only a sense of equality that your well-being is as important as mine, but in many, not all parents, but many, the well-being of my children is more important, of my family more important. I'll sacrifice my life for my family. I think that's not terribly unusual. The well-being of the family is more important. Oh, how many cases in history has a mother gone without food so they make sure that her children have food and perishes? How many times in history? So many times that we don't think it's terribly odd. We don't give out Nobel Prizes for that. We say, oh, that's what mothers do. And so she might be as ferocious as a tiger if anybody harms her children, but take it with equanimity if somebody harms her. Exchange of self for others, but a very limited others within a very small circle. My family. My family. Or in Tibet, much of Tibet traditionally was village-centered. Biggest city at Lhasa before the Chinese came in. I think it was about 50,000 population. It was a big-sized village. That was the capital, right? Everything else was much smaller. Hamlets. But oh, I've lived with Tibetans for many, many years. The identification with those in your village, very strong. And a lot would be family, extended family, third, fourth, fifth removed. But Paul, the identification with that family, you might even have your own dialect, you know. Very strong. when the monks would come to Sera, Ganden Depung in central Tibet, they would congeal, they would come together in houses based upon their home district. And there they are in their houses in the monastery speaking their own dialect. You could have 50 dialects in the same monastic university because they would gather in their own houses. And they felt, even though they're all separated from their families, most of them left their families even hundreds of miles away, but they have identified in a new circle their fellow monks from their own home district, village, and so forth. Oh, the fraternal ties there were very strong, really strong. My kamsen, my monastic house, and my college, Sera Che, not Sera Me, my university, Sera, not Ganden. All right. Gelupa, not Sakyapa. And so. So in the shamatha into vipassana in the Dzogchen approach, it's relinquishment, subtler and subtler and subtler of all grasping of I and mine, all demarcations, releasing into a singularity. And it really is, I think the word is not ill chosen, into a singularity where even your substrate consciousness collapses, dissolves, is absorbed into pristine awareness, which is non-local and atemporal, without bounds, open, expanse, and now fearless and free of suffering. There's one approach, but then as we come into the four immeasurables, what are we doing here? The practice of loving kindness, we bring to mind a dear one, a family member, that we might actually quite happily offer our own lives for. And we extend our loving kindness there. And to another family member, another very close loved one, and then to a more casual friend. But looking upon the loved one as ourselves, and then the casual friend as the dear loved one, and then the stranger as the casual friend, and then the moderate enemy as the stranger, and then the worst enemy, and leveling it all out, so that the sense of caring for and frankly identifying with goes from, I just care about me, I don't have a spouse, I don't have family, I'm just on my own here, I'm just trying to take care of my own business, good luck with you. You know, just cringing within our own skin, that I, me, mine only extends that far into my physical possessions. That's really a tiny peanut. To the family, to the circle of friends, to casual friends, to business colleagues, to strangers, to all sentient beings without demarcation. What's happening here is the sense of mine is not withdrawing, it's expanding. This is my loved one, and this is my loved one, and this is my loved one, and this is my loved one. Out to those who are displaying the worst behavior possible and caring for each of them equally. The field of, and now to use this, to put this in my under terminology, all sentient beings are my family. All sentient beings, my family. They were at one time and another in past lives, but it doesn't matter whether it's near or future. Family is family. You know? Extending out. But now the sense of my family, my limbs, the limbs of my body, extending out without, and this is so crucial, without any detours, without excluding anyone, homogeneously sweeping out into space without exclusion. We're all of the same family. And I care about you all equally. Like a very loving parent with a large family, a really loving and good parent. Well, certainly, we all know this is ideal everywhere, I think. Love all your children equally, whether it's 2 or whether it's 15. The good parent, every child of the good parent knows I'm as much loved as any other child, right? If you feel you're not, something's wrong, right? And so here it is, the Bodhisattva looking upon all sentient beings as one's own family. The sense of mine, extending out infinitely in all directions, with loving kindness, with compassion. When you see members of your family experiencing joy, success, virtue, taking delight in that as if they're your own children, your own brother and sister, spouse, parents, extending outwards, and of course the culmination of this all coming with equanimity, the grand finale of the four immeasurables, where the heart has gone supernova, expanded out to embrace all sentient beings. And the sense of identification with them, we are all kin, we are all of the same family, and caring for each one equally to oneself. But then if one conventionally demarcates, here I am, then really this is quite literal. One infinitely cares for all other sentient beings more than oneself. The priority, rather than infinitely caring about oneself more than everybody else, individually or collectively, which is the very epitome of self-centeredness, right? It's 180 degrees. Caring infinitely for all sentient beings more than oneself. So now what has happened is, like with self-grasping, the world involutes. I don't think it's a word, but I think you know what I mean. It enfolds in upon itself tiny space, tiny mind, tiny time into me. And all the world, rest of the world, becomes rather irrelevant, literally irrelevant, unrelated. And then when we practice the four immeasurables, it just turns inside out. And the identification with all sentient beings is primary. And that which is inside, when we fuse method with wisdom, is an empty set, filled with bliss. Because the empty set inside is Rigpa. So this, I think, is why in great compassion, great loving kindness, when one takes upon oneself the responsibility to liberate all sentient beings from suffering, to bring each one to enduring state of well-being, you're identifying with all sentient beings as if they're your own self. And any parent will tell their child, you must take responsibility for your own well-being. Take responsibility. You're growing up. You're not a kid anymore. Take responsibility for your own behavior, for your own future, for your conduct. Take responsibility for your own pursuit of happiness and your wish to be free of suffering. Take responsibility yourself. Don't just rely on somebody else. And that's exactly what the teachings on bodhicitta say for all sentient beings. They'll actually say, I'm sure Glenn, others, good scholars here have seen this, when you're cultivating this great compassion, don't look to somebody else. You've seen that, haven't you? Don't look to somebody else to do it. When you're attending to all sentient beings and say, who shall take on the responsibility of relieving the suffering of all sentient beings, bringing each one to liberation? Who shall do it? Don't look to somebody else. Don't say, oh, the Dalai Lama, he's much better than I. I'll pick up what he doesn't. I'll pick up the leftovers that he doesn't take care of. Don't actually say, don't look to anybody else. Because if you look to somebody else, you're right back, flat back into psyche, conventional mind. Okay, let's divvy this up. We have 36 people. Okay, that means about 3% for each person. Okay, 2.9% for you, 2.9%. I think we got it pretty well covered. It's a corporate approach to bodhicitta. But it's unrealistic. But this one, that seems the most fantastically unrealistic, is the only one that's realistic. And that is, don't look to anyone else. Because after all, there is only one Rigpa. Don't look to somebody else's Dharmakaya. From that perspective, with great compassion, you arouse your own Buddha nature. So on the trajectory, to sum up, on the trajectory of Shamatha Vipassana, we withdraw the tentacles of grasping from all that we own, all in the surrounding world that we're identifying with, because we're releasing our attention to it. Therefore, we're releasing all grasping to it. We're not paying any attention at all. Releasing back to the body with mindfulness of breathing. Releasing to the mind and settling the mind. Releasing the mind in awareness of awareness. Releasing the reified sense of I am with Vipassana and breaking through even the conventional sense of I am and my mind with Tekchu, the breakthrough, to an infinite space beyond grasping. And then the complementary approach of developing loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity, immeasurably, and then to the magnitude of great, we extend the field of mine. We extend the field of I infinitely throughout space, but to the point that there is no center, because we have exchanged self for others. So if you exchange self for others, there's no center. The center is others, and others are everywhere. And there is no center. That's Rigpa with flesh on it. It's amazing, isn't it? None of this is mine. I stand in awe. I really, utterly stand in awe of these teachings. Blow my mind. So let's practice. Settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural states. And calm this turbulent mind with mindfulness of breathing. Withdraw your awareness from the body, from the breath. Draw it inwards to the mind and the space of the mind. Withdraw your awareness from the space of the mind and its contents. To awareness itself with no spatial dimension and no location. Just the immediate experience of luminosity and cognizance. draw your awareness into that which is aware of awareness. The observer, the agent, the meditator. And from the emptiness of a localized subject, a real subject, from that emptiness, let your awareness expand above and below to all sides. And as you allow the field of your awareness to expand, whatever sentient beings arise in the space of your awareness, whether physically here in the room, who appear to your mind's eye, but of people living far away, any sentient being, breathe out and breathe in equally. With every out-breath, breathe out this breath of loving kindness, this light of loving kindness. May each one find happiness in the causes of happiness. With each in-breath, arouse a spirit of compassion. May each one be free of suffering and the causes of suffering, and imagine it to be so. You may, if you wish, venture into a variation of this classic practice of Donglen by breathing in the light of loving kindness and compassion of all the awakened ones. Breathing in the kindness of all sentient beings. And with each out-breath, breathing out the light of gratitude, of repaying the kindness of others, breathing out the light of loving kindness. are for these aspirations to become more than aspirations, to become fulfilled aspirations. Arouse, if you will, the yearning and the motivation, the intent. Achieve perfect awakening yourself, to fully realize your own Buddha nature. So that you may be enabled to realize these aspirations, however long it may take, for as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain. That you will remain as a Buddha to alleviate the suffering of the world, to liberate every being. time exists only relative to the conventional mind that demarcates past, present from future, but it has no inherent or absolute reality of its own. The time of your own enlightenment may conventionally be far away, distant in time. But the distance is not real, it's not absolute. Rest your awareness now for just a short time, releasing all aspirations, all notions of past and future. And rest in the luminous purity of your own awareness for just a moment. Oh, lots and lots today. Many, many. And little time. But that's why we have tomorrow. At least here's a short one. What does it mean to become a stream emperor? If you're on the path of your own individual liberation, so nowadays the primary school that presents this path is Theravada, you become a stream enterer when you gain realization of nirvana, and you have now irreversibly entered the stream to achieving arhatship, which means that even if you try to swim upstream, you'll still become an arhat within 7 lifetimes. So you don't have any choice. It's like falling off a bridge into a very powerful current that takes you to the ocean. Whether you swim to the side, to the left side, right side, or downstream or upstream, even if you swim with the full of your might upstream, you'll still make it to the ocean in 7 lifetimes. So something like that. Oh, yeah. Oh, so I thought maybe it would just, because it relates to earlier point, here's leftover from yesterday. And that is, do you know something about the demon and divine possession in a human body? According to Anagarika Govinda, he said he witnessed an oracle being possessed by a divine power in the old times of Tibet. Why a spirit can enter to your mind, and how to protect? So it's an interesting question, and I thought it would be interesting to answer now, because I think this particular issue of possession, here's my hypothesis. It may be wild speculation. It is speculation, but I don't think it's too wild. That I have a very strong hunch that this period of really blatant insanity in Western civilization at the dawn of modernity, from 1450 to 1700, the witch hunting era, dominated Europe and made it as far out of Europe as the East Coast, East Coast, Salem, Massachusetts, and so forth. That period, 1450 to 1700, a civilization went crazy. Not everybody in it, but the dominant gestalt was really quite insane. And my strong suspicion is that out of that pathology and out of the hysteria and out of the terror that mass delusion aroused, that was one major impetus for the particular flavor that modern science has taken. And I think there's very strong evidence of that. It's not some cockamamie idea that I just dreamed up myself. I think there's a very strong evidence for that. This radical, what do they call it? Disenchantment. The radical disenchantment of the absolutely objective world. Descartes did it, Galileo did it, Newton did it. A lot of them did it. And these were all Christian. But all of these were living, every single one of them. Copernicus, all of the great founders of modern science all lived during that witch hunting era. They were all educated in that. They probably knew somebody who had been burned or stoned or drowned or tortured to death because of being a witch. They probably did. It was so common. Tens of thousands, some people say as many as hundreds of thousands, primarily women, were killed in that fashion. And so you can imagine, if you know somebody like that, that it's just, and moreover, it's condemned. Condoned by the highest authorities in your civilization, by the church and by the state, that this is fine, this is appropriate. You can imagine the kind of the hysteria, the panic, the terror that would instill in a whole civilization. And these philosophers, these natural philosophers, really, frankly, coming to the rescue and sanitizing, depopulating, and disenchanting God's objective creation and seeking to look at it from God's own perspective and getting all those bloody demons out of there. And so they could just look at nice, inanimate building blocks of nature bumping into each other. And suddenly, even if it's barren and it's dehumanized and it's mechanical and it's devoid of spirit and devoid of goodness and ethics, at least it's devoid of spirits who could possess you and then you could be killed. Right? So when I read and when I hear, especially cognitive scientists, but not just cognitive scientists speaking, and with the glee with which they speak that we're just animals, that we're just robots, that we're mindless or what have you, whatever way they want to spin it, or the mind is just the brain, I'm hearing an echo. I'm hearing an echo that is 300-400 years old of, I will accept any belief that makes sure that there are no spirits. No spirits. Not the human spirit, not the Holy Spirit, and not demonic spirits. If to get rid of all spirits, including your own spirit, consciousness, if I have to negate, to deny my own spirit, my own consciousness, if I have to deny the Holy Spirit and gods and angels to get rid of malevolent spirits, okay, it's a rotten deal, but I'll accept it. Anything to get rid of those demonic spirits, because they scared the crap out of us for as long as the United States has been existing. That's a long time, right? 250 years. That's a long time to be pathologically, hysterically, psychotic. It's a long time. So, and so any references to ghosts, or anything that looks like it might be a ghost, like some spirit that might go from one body to the next, like in reincarnation, you'll see a powerfully emotional response, not a cool analytical, what's the objective evidence, let's evaluate it, maybe you can do your research better, we found these flaws in your research technique, but it's disgusting that you ever considered to do that type of research. We will ridicule you, we'll despise you, we'll deprive you of all funds, we will ostracize you, excommunicate you, because we don't want you to ask those questions at all. Because we will do anything, and I mean really anything, including radically dehumanizing ourselves and regarding ourselves as mindless robots, anything, absolutely, to avoid spirits coming back in. And then this wonderful being lights on the stage, who scientists all over the world love him, even if they don't believe a lot of what he says, the Dalai Lama. And he's been to major laboratories, physics laboratories, biology, neuroscience, psychology laboratories all over the world. He's been to the best, MIT, he's been to Oxford, he's been to Cambridge, I think Cambridge. He's been to Stanford, he was just at Stanford recently. They love him wherever he goes, he loves him. But would they still love him if all the scientists knew that on a regular basis he consults the state oracle? And I saw this happen. At the time, it was an extraordinarily memorable event. I think this will be the only one we get to today, but I'll save all of these up and we'll do it tomorrow. But this is kind of juicy, isn't it? And it kind of rounds off the preamble to our meditation. I was 23, maximum 24. Can't remember exactly what year, but I was studying as a monk in the Institute of Buddhist Dialectics. So it wasn't right at the beginning, because I'm quite sure I was the only Westerner, because the other two Westerners got sick and left in that first year. And we were invited, the whole monastery, 30 of us, these young monks, we were invited to be present in a really relatively small gathering. It was pretty much us and a few attendants, not many other people, to witness the state oracle being possessed, going into trance. And you see that, and you'll never forget it. And so I just gave Mary David Cheniak's email address, and I wouldn't be surprised if he would maybe open this up, that we can just download it from his internet site, because it's really a very good film that he did, showing, among other people, the state oracle going into trance, as well as some other individuals as well. But here's this man, the Dalai Lama, who's been welcomed. Oh, he was meeting with physicists way back in 1973. He went to CERN and met with a leading physicist there. This is a long time ago, 73. And then time and time again, he's been in Anton Seilinger's lab. He's met with world-class scientists of all sorts doing that. And then he goes home, and then they perform a ritual in his own, the government monastery, Namgyel Monastery in Dharamsala, where one of their major tasks is they perform the very specific ceremony, and this is what it looks like. But you'll see it, hopefully. Maybe Mary can pull this stunt off and get us to see it. We could maybe watch one film of Cliff Saran on Tuesday night and then Oracle Wednesday night, if you like. It's memorable. So here comes this man. I knew him. I mean, I didn't know him much, but I knew him, the state oracle, because he was a very close friend of the Dalai Lama's personal physician, and I lived in his home. So the state oracle would come over to his house, and they would play, mahjong together. The state oracle, pretty ordinary guy. He was a monk, but when he wasn't being possessed, pretty ordinary dude. And they would, anybody seen Tibetan playing mahjong, they really love it. So these two old monks, so he plays mahjong and he gets possessed by a deity. So what was it like being among 30 monks, watching a much smaller group of monks, maybe a dozen monks from Namgyel Monastery? And there's a state oracle dressed in this very, very ornate garb, I mean all brocade and all kinds of so very elaborate costume, with a 30-pound crown waiting to be put on his head at the appropriate time. And it's a massive thing, and it is 30 pounds. So what, 15 kilos or so, 13 kilos. And so we're sitting there quietly, and then these monks start doing their chanting. And they are invoking the particular deity, a god, a being, who this oracle had already been prepared to receive. Now, he's often, in the case of the state oracle, he learns about it spontaneously. Now, from the outside, you say, oh, he's having epileptic this is a person who had naturally epileptic seizures, and the Tibetans picked up on that, and they really like asking questions to people having epilepsy. And that makes really good sense. That is, the so-called skeptic, that is the person who absolutely refuses to accept to question his own assumptions, the skeptic, who completely refuses to question his own assumptions, the skeptic, which is to say skeptical of other people's beliefs, I would say, well, the oracle, what's happening there is quite clearly, if you watch him, the man's having a seizure. If you studied his brain at that time, you would almost certainly find exactly the brain activity of a person having an epileptic seizure. And that's what's happening. That's all that's happening. They found a person who naturally has seizures, and then they glom onto him and think he's possessed. And that makes really good sense until you bring into the equation that the Dalai Lama is posing questions to this person having ostensibly an epileptic seizure, listening intently and sometimes basing policies of state on the basis of a person who's psychotic. So somebody is crazy here. Is it the Dalai Lama asking questions of a person who's having a psychotic fit? Or who's crazy? Because something doesn't compute here. So what we witnessed was these monks went into their chanting ritual, and it's got full regalia. It's got the monks are all dressed, and they've got their ritual instruments, and they got their long horns, and they got their cymbals, and they have their chanting going. And I must say, I knew what generally that we're about to see a man go into trance. It was eerie. It was eerie. It was really rather awesome. And we're just watching the oracle just sitting there, and he's just a mahjong player, sitting there with a lot of ornate clothing on. And then before long, it was probably maybe 10 minutes, something like that, into this ritual. Then apparently this ritual, so I think I'm going to leave off the outside skeptical thing. Apparently this was a ritual designed to induce epileptic seizures. Well, that's one view of it. But bear in mind, if you're inside a smaller peanut, what's in a bigger peanut doesn't make any sense. And that is, it makes sense, but only in your context. You have to make sense of it in terms of something familiar. The closest thing that is familiar is an epileptic seizure. Therefore, this must be an epileptic seizure. The Dalai Lama, otherwise a highly intelligent, keenly educated person, now believes that people with epileptic seizures make really wise statements. So again, the smaller peanut doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. The larger peanut says that, get over it. There's a bigger picture here that you don't pick up by studying the objective, the physical, the quantifiable. So what we saw was this man is sitting there quietly, and then suddenly it was like he stuck his finger into an electric socket. Now this is a 35-year-old memory, so it's not infallible, but you'll see for yourself in the film if we get to see it here, and otherwise it shouldn't be too hard to track down. It was like he stuck his finger into an electric socket, and his body jolted, and you saw clearly some strange and didn't look very pleasant at all. Transformation is taking place in this person, and his eyes are rolling up, and clearly this looked like a fit. I mean, it looked like this man is having a really hard time. And as I recall, now it's a 35-year-old memory, then he gets up and he starts kind of a ritual dance. He moves around. But I think before he's fully getting up, and when it's quite clear, now I'll just speak from the Tibetan perspective, when this entity has possessed him, taken over his mind. It was almost like playing pool. You got one ball here and another ball here, and you put some backspin on the first ball, so it goes, and the other ball goes shooting off, and the ball you hit takes place of the earlier ball. Well, something like that, and that is this deity, this entity comes in like a billiard ball, and knocks this person's consciousness, this person's psyche, right down into the substrate consciousness. Pew! And then the deity's billiard ball mind is where the other one used to be. Now, he didn't kill him, but basically he just knocked him out, knocked his lights out. So his psyche just dissolved into the substrate consciousness, and the one that's left is the deity's. And then once that's happened, then the attendants who've done this many, many times, then they put on this cap, which is already this cap, this crown. Then they strap it on and they cinch it down really tight. And then that's when he gets up, and then he dances around, swaying his head. And it would look like this would give rise to a neck ache that would last for weeks if you're normal. But that's why they don't cinch it down until he's completely possessed, because something has taken over this person, which just doesn't seem to be human. He dances around, and again the ceremony is going on, the chanting is going on, the ritual instruments going on, and then he sits down. And you look at it and you say, that has the outer appearance of being a human being, but whatever is gazing out doesn't look human to me. Now, you can always do the reduction, well, that's because he's crazy. Or you can think, maybe these Tibetans aren't crazy. Maybe the Dalai Lama isn't crazy. Maybe something really absolutely outside the sphere of modern science, which arose in large part in a reaction to this, exactly this. But this is a benign possession, invited possession. He sits there, and then a representative from the Dalai Lama, the Tibetan government in exile, then comes to him. And there's a person who's spent a lot of time doing this. He's basically the interpreter. And then questions are posed. They have a whole list of questions being posed to this person who's possessed. And these are issues of state policy. What's going to happen to Tibet? What this, what that? You know, basically it's like going to a Henry Kissinger or some old statesman saying, what do you take? What do you say, old wise man? What do you say? And they're posing these questions one by one. And then a voice comes out and responds to the questions one by one. But sometimes the words coming out, now bear in mind, the state oracle is generally not a highly educated man. He's not a real scholar. He's a monk, but really in ordinary life is pretty ordinary and not a great scholar. I think they're never great scholars, and they're not great contemplatives. They may not meditate at all. They basically just offered up this life to be a service because they don't get any benefit out of this. I mean, they got bumped like a billiard ball. Whenever this has happened, they're out. They don't remember, right? And so these questions are posed, but sometimes the answer comes out in verse, in archaic ancient Tibetan, using terminology the guy doesn't even know. And when he sees the transcripts of the answers he gave afterwards, he can't even understand it. And so the epileptic seizure interpretation really doesn't work very well. It's their best shot. What else are they going to say? And now we believe in spirits. Oh. Rewrite the last 400 years. And so questions are posed, but there's a person with him. Uh-oh, we're going way over time. The person with him has listened to this a lot because the voice is hard to understand. And we, 30 monks in the monastery, we came up one by one to basically receive a blessing, you know, like offer a scarf and receive a blessing, not from the oracle, because he's just an ordinary guy, but from the deity who's possessed him. And so I came up there like everybody else and kind of offered a kata and then got the blessing. But during that little time that I was right next to him, when I came up for my turn, then I could hear his voice when he was answering, because we're just filing silently. We're not asking questions. The government is asking questions. But I could hear his voice as he was giving an answer. And it was the strangest voice I've ever heard, because it didn't sound human. And give an analogy, it would be like taking a $500,000 Lamborghini engine and putting that into a 1960 VW Bug, Volkswagen, yeah. Like the engine just doesn't fit in this chassis at all, and then flooring it. I mean, just hitting the accelerator, pedal to the metal. It was like the energy coming through was going to basically shatter the chassis if it continued on too long. The energy coming just through the speech was like, I can't bear this, and it was like a horse's neigh. So I'm hesitant to try to imitate it, or just like a joke, but it was like that. Like it's just way too much energy for human voice, human vocal cords, to be able to just deliver it. It was like, you know, just massive, and then just coming out like that, but coming out articulate, and then the interpreter writing this all down, understanding it, and then this is turned over to scholars to be able to read, and then it's turned over to the Dalai Lama. He wasn't there. The message would be passed over to him. So, very memorable experience. And then when it's all over, when the questions have been posed, then there is a ritual ending. So this is a very special epileptic seizure. You can induce it, you can also stop it with ritual. Very special. No medication needed. They perform a ritual, and then the deity departs. And when he departs, this man collapses. And they really quickly get that crown off his head, because they don't want him to strangle. And then they literally put him on a gurney, a stretcher, and they roll him out. And then he basically needs at least 24 hours, 48 hours, just to rest, and maybe play mahjong over at the doctor's house. So this was all intentional. It's benign. The entity coming in is not infallible, but is considered to be living in a very large peanut, and that is a larger worldview than most human beings have, is consulted, taken, but like, again, maybe Henry Kissinger is a bad example, but I'll stick with it, because a lot of people have sought his counsel. I think very few people, I don't know anybody, think he's infallible, unless maybe he, I don't know. But they'll take, well, this is a man with a lot of experience in statesmanship and so forth, so let's take very seriously what he says. And we may plan policy on it, because his perspective is much greater than most people, because he's been doing this for 50 years or whatever. So something like that. They won't take infallible, but they'll take it really into consideration. And they will orient state policy and big decisions around the statements, the answers given, by this being. And then it departs. But this being has basically made a commitment, a promise to be on call and to answer questions when needed. And sometimes it's done on a regular basis, at time of crisis, then that will be given. And I'm almost certain, I'm not quite absolutely certain, but in this time of tremendous peril, I mean, perhaps the greatest drama in the history of Tibet, March 10, 1959, when had the Dalai Lama been captured, history would be different. Our history would be different. We wouldn't be here. I would not be here. Because the very first Dharma teacher I ever had in Göttingen was appointed by the Dalai Lama. The first monastery I ever went to was created by the Dalai Lama. And then I went to Dharamsala, that was to the library created by the Dalai Lama. And it was there because he was there. So history, I mean, that's just my own personal history, but a lot of history would be different had the Dalai Lama not been able to escape at the age of 24. So they saw hell was about to break loose. There were tens of thousands of Tibetans who had fled from this awful scourge of destruction, of decimation, sweeping across like a bonfire, incinerating Tibetan culture. From east to west, tens of thousands of Tibetans, especially Kamba, gathering in Lhasa to be near the Dalai Lama, their one refuge, one embodied refuge, to be near him. Another great lama is there, but above all the Dalai Lama. And then the uprising, and then the iron fist coming down and absolutely crushing them. And in the midst of this, the Dalai Lama off there in his winter palace in the Norbolinka, knowing those 9 years of trying to negotiate has just finished. And he was invited to a party just around that time. He was invited to a party by Chinese government officials. They were very insistent. Come to this party. By the way, leave your bodyguards behind. You won't need them. This is within days of March 10th, 1959. Leave your body. You won't need them. But you are coming to this party. That's one party that if he goes to, he's never coming out. So then he knew it's finished. All of his 9 years, from the age of 15 to 24, trying to negotiate with his government, all in ashes. And the only thing he can possibly do is leave his whole family behind. His personal family, yeah, they can come. But his whole family, Tibetan people, who rely upon him as their sole refuge. The only way he can serve them is to leave them and maybe never see them again. Because he's never seen them again. 51 years. How to get out? How to get out when the whole city is surrounded by massive Chinese military. They're surrounded. I mean, he's in Winter Palace. Everybody knew where he was. There was no mystery there. He was in the Chinese knew he's in the Winter Palace. They had him checkmate in one move. We are going to capture the king, and the game is over. Checkmate. Tibet loses. And he's the 24-year-old king who needs to escape to preserve his whole culture. How do you make that decision? Do you go left, right, north, south, east, west? What route? How do you choose? They consulted the state oracle. And he gave them exactly step by step. Go here, and then go there, and then go there, and then out this way. And he got out. Obviously, he got out. So there's benign possession. There's malevolent possession. There are protections for malevolent possession. There are rituals for inviting and benevolent. But for ourselves, the best protection is loving kindness. Whatever beings there may be out there, benevolent or malevolent, if they're sentient beings, they're sentient beings like ourselves. And just send out waves of loving kindness in all directions, excluding no one. And that's your best protection. Oh, that's so.